listening to All the Best. I'm Michael Bryden. There's a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. Parents tell their kids that because they know it's unattainable. You can never reach the end of the rainbow. A rainbow is a scientific phenomenon. It's caused through the refraction of light through water. And that's why you can't reach it, because the closer you get to them, the further away they move. It's a trick of perspective. But not last week. Last week, a rainbow was reached. Last week, the US Supreme Court overturned a whole bunch of state bans on gay marriage and ruled that same-sex couples have a constitutional right to get married. It's a big step forward for the US and marks a change in momentum for the LGBTIQA community worldwide. So today on All the Best, we're looking back at some of our stories on the issue. It's easy to forget that briefly, in December 2013, same-sex marriage was legalised in the Australian Capital Territory. Judy Orlett, a Canberra-based celebrant, performed 11 same-sex marriage ceremonies in the 5 days it was legal. She tells the story to Fars Edraki.
Will you answer me right now, these questions as your wedding vow? Yes, I will answer you right now, your questions as my solemn vow, provided our guests don't have a cow. Will you love him if he's rich? Will you love her in a ditch? Will you love him for richer, for poorer? Will you love her for quiet or snorer? From today until the cows come home and never stop writing goofy poems.
That's Judy Orlick, a civil marriage celebrant in Canberra. She's done over 700, maybe even 800 weddings. She says she's lost track. But those Dr. Seuss vows were one of the most memorable. Until late last year. Judy gets a phone call one afternoon when she's in Perth. The ACT had just passed a law allowing same-sex couples to marry, the first of its kind in Australia. Her phone wouldn't stop ringing, she says.
All of a sudden, couples were ringing me saying we want to move our wedding to this 5-day period.
For those few days before the High Court strikes down the territory law, Judy is in the middle of a media frenzy.
It was a crazy weekend, I have to say, and I am not cut out to be a Kardashian. But there was actually a film crew from Sydney who had decided that the way that they would follow that weekend was to follow me, because I had 11 ceremonies. There were 31 couples that married in Canberra. They were all lovely, but the one that truly did stand out, Veronica and Krishna. As everybody filed into the auditorium, there were bongo drums, five women playing bongo drums. Fabulous, loud, fabulous rhythm that people were bopping to as they came into the theatre. It just set the most electric kind of atmosphere. They came on from opposite sides of the stage with their families behind them. When they met in the middle, they did a waltz to the bongo drums for quite some time. We did the ceremony, which was joyful and fun, and everybody sort of clapped and cheered. As we signed papers, the choir and everybody else, they sang Love Is in the Air, which is what they sang in the Legislative Assembly when the Marriage Equality Same-Sex Act passed. I have a friend who's always worked in politics, and she's been a political advisor, and she said she's never known anything like it. Because you don't speak, you can't do anything like that when you're in the Legislative Assembly. Love is in the air, everywhere I look around. So I've always done ceremonies for same-sex couples. There are a lot of celebrants who are unsure how to do that. You know, they see it as a different being. I see it as the same. You know, it's the same emotion, the same commitment that they're making to each other. I've always done them in exactly the same sort of way. And you often, in my professional chat room, you'll often hear celebrants saying, I've got my first commitment ceremony. Has anyone got any ideas for possible wording? I don't quite understand that. For me, it's much more a question of not why do I, rather why don't they? The most amazing thing about being a celebrant is the variety of people you meet. You see people with quite raw emotion, you know, and sometimes quite, you know, seriously moving. I had one person I married who subsequently, this couple contacted me 3 years later and his wife was then in Claire Holland House in the last stages of her life with terminal breast cancer, and they wanted me to do her funeral. And so I spoke and told the story of their relationship as I had told it at the ceremony, and I was able to say, and I don't want to use his name in case by any chance someone would recognise him, I'll call him Mick, absolutely lived these vows. And I could quote from some of the vows because he'd cared for his wife for a year. I'll be there for you for the rest of your life. You know, that's what people promise in one way or another, never for a minute assuming that their lives are going to be cut short. And this young man was. He cared for his wife for 12 months. He took leave from his work and was with her when she took her last breath. You have dogs often. I've had two Great Danes that have come on a flatbed truck with white ribbons and a ring on each one. They were canine handlers with the AFP, so that was very appropriate. I didn't marry the dogs. I've never moved into animal marriages. Perhaps that's a niche.
Wait, does that remind you of something?
Will that be a future step? Will that be one of the things that say, well, you know, these two creatures love each other? You know, maybe they should be able to join in a union.
Sorry, Corey, doesn't look like it's going to happen just yet.
No, I married the couple, but the bridesmaids came in with these two. Really, the dogs pulled the bridesmaids in because they were very strong dogs. I had never thought of being a celebrant. I don't think I'd been to any weddings since I'd got married myself. My own kids hadn't got old enough to go to weddings. And a friend of mine decided that she wanted to be a celebrant and persuaded me to train with it. She said, look, we'd be great. Why don't we do it together? So it was completely by chance. It was not something I'd anticipated, thought about. It was only if she hadn't suggested it, I don't think I would have ever thought of it, to be honest. Look, marriage is going to be around for a long, long time, way, way longer than I'm around. I think there will always... There's a number of marriages have stayed pretty constant over the last decade, for example. Celebrants do more than their fair share. I think it's close to 70% of marriages are done by civil celebrants. I think getting married in a church is less likely, and it's less common now than being married by a civil celebrant. It will do me out quite well. But it's one of the few jobs where being older isn't really a disadvantage, unless you're on the Zimmer frame. You know, that might be a hard look to pull off. I think young people nowadays have thought much more seriously about what marriage means to them than when I married 40-odd years ago. Then you married your first boyfriend. You know, I married in my school church. I had the wedding my mum didn't have because she married during the war. Nowadays, I think couples, they've lived together. Overwhelmingly, they live together. There's only a handful of people you marry that don't live together before they marry. Very few people actually write their own vows from scratch. What they sort of do is look at all the examples, pick bits from here and there. But their vows show that they have thought a great deal about what's involved in marriage. I wish you a life full of sunshine and cheer and a love that grows deeper year after year. Now I, by the authority vested in me, declare that husband and wife you shall be. You're married now, so kiss the bride, but please do keep it dignified. So you can get married almost any way you like.
That was Judy Orlick chatting to our producer, Farzed Raki, about the time she performed 11 same-sex marriage ceremonies in the brief 5-day window where it was legal to do that in the ACT. Today on All the Best, we're celebrating the US Supreme Court decision to legalize same-sex marriage across the United States. In Australia, we're fighting a different battle, and change will come not from the courts, but from our politicians. Unlikely alliances will have to be made. Sounds tricky, right? Well, not so much. It's happening now. This next story is a favourite of ours from Kate Doak, who made it for the show back in 2012 when she discovered an unusual parliamentary friendship group. ¶¶
Hello, I'm Kate Doak. I'm a journalist, a political junkie, and I have to say that it's not often that I'm surprised by anything in politics. But I was stunned when I heard that a couple of months ago that a same-sex and gender-diverse parliamentary friendship group had been formed in Canberra. Few people even know that this group exists. It's made up of a bunch of politicians who want to educate other politicians about lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans and intersex issues. And what's most amazing is that it's tripartisan, made up of Greens, Labourites and even Liberal members of Parliament, known to be conservative in every other way. Take Warren Entsch, for example. As a chief opposition whip in the House of Reps, with the nickname of Crocodile Dundee, he's as staunchly liberal as he can get. And yet, here he is speaking proudly at the second gathering of this group, held in Parliament House recently.
The Parliamentary Friendship Group for the LGBTI community. I am certainly honoured to be here today, and I have to admit I'm quite emotional standing here tonight. There's no doubt what we're doing here this evening is something of a milestone. It was in July last year that my colleagues Graham Perrott and Sarah Hanson-Young came together to establish the Parliamentary Friendship Group, and we recognised very
As you heard, Warren Entsch, along with the Greens' Sarah Hanson-Young and the ALP's Graham Perrott, began the group and now co-chair it together. While we hear daily updates about our deeply divided Parliament, this one little group showcases just how powerful the call for equality can be. So what would it take for three people from such diverse political backgrounds to work passionately on same-sex and gender rights together? Well, I think I'll let them answer that one for themselves. Here's Graham Perrott.
Too many constituents told me their children were bullied and belittled because they were same-sex attracted. Some were even driven to suicide. I cannot sit idly by while the nation is complicit in this harm. It is time for this nation to protect committed monogamous relationships, whatever the gender of the adults who wish to have their relationship recognised by the state.
Then Sarah Hanson-Young had this to say at a dinner at the University of New England a couple of days later.
I just want to make something very clear from the beginning, and it shouldn't matter, but I want to make it very clear. I'm a very straight woman. I like men. And some my girlfriends would argue I like men a bit too much sometimes. I've been married. I was able to participate in being married. I got married quite young. I had a daughter. And now my ex-husband is one of the best fathers I think this country's got. And he's definitely the best father for my daughter. But we're friends. But I'm a passionate believer that regardless of someone's sexuality or gender, that they shouldn't be discriminated against. I feel very strongly and personally that it is an issue of human rights and social justice.
But the explanation that really blew me away was how Warren Entsch, remember, he's a staunch liberal, became involved in the transgender community. When I first walked into Warren Entsch's office in Parliament House earlier this year for an interview, I honestly didn't know what to expect. There was a crocodile skull hanging off his bookshelf, and paintings of stockmen driving cattle hung up on the wall. I could never have expected him to share this very personal story from the 1970s, back when he was living in Georgetown, which is 400 kilometres northwest of Cairns.
I actually became aware of gender diverse issues much earlier in my life. Actually, at a time when I was riding that horse at the, I was there, that's probably out near Croydon, and I was actually going with a young girl who was a barmaid at Normanton Hotel, and we used to go to Georgetown every weekend for weekends, and she had a cousin there who, for some reason, didn't buy many beers when we went out. He always was with us. He didn't buy too many beers, and I found myself buying beer for him, and whenever you get a few beer, more beer, this person got in, and more feminine he became, and used to end up in having to defend him at different times, people that didn't know him. And I often said to him, you know, for goodness sake, it's bad enough you don't buy a beer, but if I'm going to buy a beer, for goodness sake, don't be such a Sheila. Because in doing that, I'm always spending more time having a blue, trying to protect you, than I am having a drink. And I've only got the weekend. It was quite funny. But anyway, before Christmas one year, he disappeared. And it was some months later, I was sitting at the Normanton Hotel with my then girlfriend's mother and father, who were running the pub. And I see this young lass come flitting through in short shorts and a boob tube, and I said, oh, who the hell's that? And they told me that that was the guy. And the reason he hadn't been spending his money, he'd been saving his money and going down to Sydney, and had his agenda changed.
Knowing someone who had personally gone through that experience was enough for Warren to decide what side he fell on. In 2006, Warren was interviewed about his views on gay rights, and he shared the story of that young man who'd finally decided to show the world who she really was.
And a few days later, I got this email that caused me to really tear up. And it started off by saying, "Dear Warren, thank you for sharing your/our story." And she went on then to say to me, you know, hadn't been people like you back in those days, you know, that were there prepared to defend me, that, you know, I'd never been able to achieve what I had. She also made a comment that she never ever felt discrimination until she went to the cities. Mm-hmm. Now, and what happened? She went on and she got a year 12, went to university, and at the time of writing in 2004, she'd just graduated as a medical doctor working in a hospital in Melbourne. And she said that her commitment was to rural Australia, and she was doing a rural doctor's course, and she was going to be going in to be a doctor in rural areas. I saw her for the first time since 1979, about 4 weeks ago. I was asked to speak at a transgender sister girl and gender diverse conference in Cairns. And this quite attractive blonde come out of the group and come up and give me a big kiss. And I thought, wow, hello, how are you? Then I stepped back and I looked, and she says, do you remember me? She's gorgeous, and she's working in a Far North Queensland hospital now as a doctor.
Dr. Alana Young is now a member of a roundtable group of experts who have prepared a new report into the well-being of sex and gender diverse Australians. The report found that these Australians regularly experience high levels of stigma and violence, which has resulted in social isolation, unemployment, depression and suicide. The report was launched at the Parliamentary Friendship Group in Canberra. I want to take you behind the scenes of this meeting so that you can see how this little group of Greens, Labor and Liberal politicians are working to change things and getting others involved along the way.
I am not the most qualified person in this room to speak about the contents of this report, and as such, feel a little bit overwhelmed standing here. I'm a muso. I have sung as long as I can remember. It's always been my single greatest love, and I always dreamed of a day when I might be able to get up and perform on a big stage in front of a massive adoring crowd with a big band behind me. I never really understood why this thing that I most loved to do was something that I was unable to step into in my life. I would sing for friends, I would sing for family, I would sing shamelessly in supermarket aisles and elevators, and yet I just couldn't seem to find the missing link that was preventing me from stepping in. There was a not rightness in myself. Something just didn't feel right in me, and I didn't know what that was for a long time. And it wasn't until my early 30s that I realised that the core issue that was holding me back in my life was my gender.
This is Paige Phoenix. You might know him from The X Factor, where he made international headlines as the show's first transsexual singer. These days, he's getting up in front of audiences to share some of the stories that he's encountered.
I met a family on Sunday who have just endured over a year of court battles at a personal cost of $20,000 to secure the right
to access appropriate and necessary medical interventions for their daughter. I speak daily to folks who cannot get their sex marker on their birth certificates amended because the surgeries required by the state are either unaffordable or inappropriate for them. We are still scrambling for resources to educate people working with SNGD people and for centres to provide assistance to these people themselves. Folks in the Northern Territory, Tasmania and Perth can't even get access to medical services for transition period. And the gaps in equity and understanding continue to contribute to a society in which SNGD people feel missed and misunderstood. While I was writing this, I was talking to a 21-year-old trans guy on Facebook who had decided to end his life before his 21st birthday, and the only way that he is hanging on is by cutting himself daily. And he's still not sure why he's here. And I've been trying to convince him that things are going to get better. That it's going to get better.
At this point, Paige needed to stop to collect himself. Politicians stood by, listening with tears rolling down their cheeks.
This report lays the framework for the way forward. We can no longer say that we didn't know. We can no longer say that we didn't have the information. I have every faith in the Health and Diversity Report and that it will be used positively to begin to address the high levels of stigma, violence, discrimination and prejudice currently being experienced by SNGD people in Australia. And I look forward to a day when more people from my community are able to relay an experience that's been as positive as my own. I sing a lot now. I sing and I sing and I sing, still in supermarket aisles and elevators, and sometimes on the big stage. This life is way too precious to go half-lived.
The report has made a whole lot of recommendations, including the need to address the lack of medical benefits and the inadequacies of laws at both the national and state levels. But Warren Entsch has an even simpler strategy for changing the way people think about sex and gender diverse Australians, both inside and outside of national politics.
Let's start talking about transgender. Let's start talking about intersex. I find that when I talk particularly on intersex, most of my colleagues have no idea what I'm talking about. In fact, some of them quietly come and ask me what it is. They don't understand. And so I take great delight in explaining to them. And while I've all, it's almost like turning a light bulb on. My own perspective, and I can see it with many of my colleagues. I mean, when I started raising these issues, I think back in 2003, 2004, it was like dropping a hand grenade or a stink bomb into the party room when I would stand up and speak about it, because you'd see people almost cringing and wanting to climb under desks and just didn't want to participate. I organised for some people to tell their stories, and one of the people that I invited, all my colleagues, and not many turned up, but one that did turn up was Barnaby Joyce. And he was so taken by what he heard and the discussions he had. He was the first one, and I think I told you this, that actually stood up in the party room and said, "I support what I'm doing." And from there, I've seen suddenly I'd get people coming to me in the corridors and saying, "Good on you, keep going on it, I really support you," but nobody's looking, I hope they don't see me, to now where people openly support me. What I'm finding very encouraging is that the younger ones that are coming in here now, they have a very, very different and a very, very tolerant and accepting position. My discussions with Tony Abbott, the leader, has shows me that he is not sort of locked close on these views. He has quite an open mind and is very, very accepting, and I think people will be very surprised at to what level of acceptance that Tony has in relation to these issues. So there are a small group there that will never entertain it, and so I don't criticise people for this. I mean, my colleagues, I've got a couple of my colleagues there that are always sort of ribbing me for my advocacy, you know. I wear that as a badge of honour.
Now, as a journalist, I normally feel pretty uncomfortable about becoming involved within a story. But Warren's pride, his badge of honour, in speaking about these issues made me think about my own life and the journey I've had to become the person that I am today. There I was, sitting in a corner of a room, recording Warren as he spoke about the work that this little group had left to do for sex and gender diverse Australians, when suddenly he said this.
In my office a couple of months ago, I was asked about, in my view, some very inappropriate responses by I think it was the Australian Christian Lobby, and a gentleman by the name of Colin Duck turned up to do an interview. And we sat down and we talked, and he asked me why I responded in the way that I did. At the end, by the time we'd finished that interview, Colin told me that he was really Kate. And he told me his story, or her story, how she was trying to transition and the challenges that she'd had within her own family and what have you. And Kate's here tonight. Kate's still a journo. Nice to see you here, Kate. At the end of it, we ended up, he went to shake my hand, I gave him a hug and I said, you know, really, more power to you. You've got to make this work. And it's great to see you here, Kate. It really is. Because it's been difficult. Kate's faced the challenges, but I think you're going to get there, Kate. I really think you're going to get there. And I'm hoping that the work that's been done through A Agenda will make sure that that makes that transition just a little bit easier.
I'm Kate Doak, a journalist, a trans person, and yes, a political junkie and cynic. And there I was, once again stunned by the good that could come out of Canberra just when you least expect it.
That story was produced by Kate Doak. We make this show at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and Triple R in Melbourne and 4ZZZ in Brisbane. Our features executive producers are Heidi Pett and Jess O'Callaghan. My co-host is Pip Rasmussen, and I'm Michael Bryden. Thanks to Farzad Raki and Kate Doak for their stories in today's episode. All the Best is played across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. And if you want to hear more stories, visit allthebestradio.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.